did do breast surgery, but Dr. Block asked me to come here today and talk about the history of breast cancer or breast surgery, and I decided not to bring a slideshow and to rather be a little more interactive and talk to you about how we might make advances in medical care in a lot of different ways. And we'll use breast cancer as an example. And the example is meant to highlight the importance of stepwise clinical research. We don't make advances by an individual doctor saying, gee, I think I'm going to try something new. Actually, I should have brought a card. There's a great cartoon I have where you have a patient being put to sleep on an operating table, and one surgeon saying to the next, okay, okay, heads will do it my way, tails will try Larry's stupid procedure. With the patient sitting there going, what's going on here, right? So that's the original clinical trial. But it's not to try Larry's stupid procedure and not to let Larry say, well, I know the best way to do it. And there's many examples in breast cancer surgery and medicine of people who have great ideas, and then when the clinical research is done, that proves that their great idea didn't work. Actually, there's a really good example of that from about 20 years ago. Of course, we have a big bone marrow transplant program here at Roswell Park, mostly for hematologic malignancies, leukemias, lymphomas. And back in the late 1980s, there was a doctor named William Peters who was at Duke. And this was when chemotherapy was really being shown to be effective in breast cancer. And a lot of people thought, well, if 100 milligrams of chemotherapy is effective, well, 200 milligrams must be more effective, right? And the problem is 200 milligrams destroys all your bone marrow and you die because you don't create blood cells. And so the dose-limiting side effect, the dose-limiting toxicity of chemotherapy was bone marrow suppression. Is this making sense? And but Dr. Peters said, well, let's test it. And he worked up through clinical research. He worked up through experimental means, and they did a phase 2 trial. Do you guys know what a phase 2 trial is? A phase 1 trial is what?
Safety.
I mean, it's basically, does it cause bad side effects, right? And you actually, the traditional phase 1 trial is you just increase the level, the dose, until it's not safe, right? And then you back off. We have a phase 1, drug trial unit here right now that's operating right now, because that's how we've made progress. And he did a phase 2 study. There was indications that there was indications that it could be done, and he did a phase 2 trial of high-dose chemotherapy with bone marrow transplant to rescue the patients. So they'd harvest the bone marrow from the person before they gave them the chemotherapy, put the bone marrow in a freezer, and then give very high-dose chemotherapy that would completely destroy the bone marrow and presumably kill the cancer cells too. And when after some period of time, when the chemotherapy was washed out, they took the bone marrow out of the freezer, which of course had not been treated with chemotherapy because it was in the freezer, and they gave the bone marrow back. That's a bone marrow transplant, right? And it takes some time for the bone marrow cells to engraft in the bone marrow and actually start producing blood cells again. And he said, look, I looked at the people we treated for the 2 years before we started doing this with the same extent of breast cancer as these women, and I looked at the women that we treated this way, and the women that we treated, are many more of them are surviving their breast cancer. So bone marrow transplant is maybe a good treatment for breast cancer, right? That was an historical control. You presumably have learned that historical controls are valuable in phase 2 studies but are not definitive, right? And do you know what a historical control is? What's an historical control if you're doing clinical trials, clinical research? You take people who were treated some time ago, and you see how they were treated, and you treat somebody with a different treatment, and look at how they did, and your control group is is the people who were treated before you started the new treatment. What would be the shortcomings of an historical control group? Well, there's limited. I changed that a little bit because you don't really know exactly what happened to them, Okay, other things? Maybe they're not really comparable patients, right? And in this case, actually, it turned out that what they did was, one of the things they did was they did a lot more CAT scans and things on the people who were going to get the bone marrow transplant to make sure that there was no evidence that they had spread of cancer than they would have done 2 years ago. So probably they were treating people with the bone marrow transplant who were less likely to have a recurrence in the first place. But to Dr. Peters' enormous credit, Dr. Peters said, we've shown in a phase 2 study that this appears to have efficacy. What should you do then? What would the next step be? And what is a phase 3 trial? And how do you decide who gets what treatment? Well, it's sort of hard to double-blind bone marrow transplant because you get really sick in the transplant unit or you don't, so it's hard to double-blind. But what are you really saying? Somebody said that. You randomize them, right. So you ask people who are potentially eligible for this to allow a randomization to determine whether they get a bone marrow transplant or standard therapy. It took a long time to complete the study because with the public, so again, to his credit, he sponsored the study, but a lot of other people took his work. And if you look at the history of bone marrow transplants in the mid-1990s, programs all over the country sprung up, and they were mostly doing breast cancer bone marrow transplant based on the phase 2 data. Okay? And finally, the randomized trial was done. It was even compounded more because there was a randomized trial for women with very advanced breast cancer done in South Africa, which showed a benefit to bone marrow transplant. No other study then showed it. The big study in the United States showed absolutely no benefit to bone marrow transplant. The women who got the bone marrow transplant were just as likely to be alive as the women who got the standard treatment. Absolutely no benefit. Nobody could figure out why the South Africa guy had such good results. So actually a delegation of people from the United States and Europe went down to look at his data. It turned out he'd fabricated his data. Unfortunately, this test of bone marrow transplantation showed that bone marrow transplantation did not improve outcome over standard therapy. Bone marrow transplants across the United States closed their doors and had to refocus on what we focus on, which is the hematologic malignancies. So I want to talk today about breast surgery, and remember that everything that people say is true needs to be tested. And we test that through appropriately done clinical research. So if you have advanced breast cancer right now, you are not offered bone marrow transplant. I forgot to mention the other problem. The problem is that 5% of the people who got the bone marrow transplant died within 30 days of the transplant because it's a very toxic therapy. So there's many examples of clinical trials that have showed that the new treatment is not beneficial. So using breast cancer surgery as this backdrop, let's go back to the mid-1800s, okay? People got breast cancer back in the 1800s. And in fact, you can actually go way back into ancient history and see examples in carvings and etchings of women with breast cancer. Some horrific things that were done to people in the Renaissance and Middle Ages, you know, with these tumors. But when women got breast cancer, it inexorably grew, and it's a horrible disease. I mean, having a big tumor growing in your breast that's bleeding and gets infected and is painful is a horrible thing. And just like many other cancers, have neck cancers, anything that's particularly on the surface is, you know, very difficult. It's disfiguring. It makes you not welcome in society, right? But some people would live a long time. So this was a horrible death for many women, and people inexorably went on to die of breast cancer. Now, perhaps not as many died of breast cancer in the centuries past, because the median sort of the average survival wasn't 60 years or 70 years or 80 years, right? So people didn't live as long to get breast cancer. But for those people who did, it could be a horrific death. So. Then came and people recognized you might be able to remove the tumor, but you doing elective surgery was very difficult. If you look at the Civil War, doing surgery in the Civil War pretty much involved giving some people some stiff drinks, having four people hold them down and amputate their leg. That was surgery in the Civil War, right? And that's how people lived is you got rid of the gangrenous leg. And then anesthesia became. Anesthesia was developed in the 1870s, 1880s, and particularly the Mass General. If you go to the Mass General, you can still see the. They actually have a museum of it. If you're in Boston, you can go to the Mass General Museum. They have a lot of the artifacts back from there. It's open to the public. But they still have the amphitheater where the first operations under anesthesia were done. But ether was used, and they had a mask, and you controlled it, and somebody would. It was an art to control ether anesthesia. Of course, if you give too much ether, the person stops breathing. But you were able to make people unconscious, and you could control the pain sensation, so you could do elective surgery. So very quickly in the late 1800s, surgical techniques developed. And one of the surgical techniques that was developed by a man named William Halsted. Dr. Halsted was a surgeon in Baltimore. He actually was quite a Renaissance man. He did breast cancer. He did brain surgery. Some of the very early ways of doing taking care of pituitary tumors and the like. And he actually started the modern training programs for doctors in the United States, where doctors go to medical school and then they do an apprenticeship called a residency in a hospital, where they have progressive levels of responsibility. And this was Halsted. So. Halsted saw these women with these large breast cancers and said, well, we can do surgery on them. And he had this hypothesis that breast cancers spread from the breast to regional lymph nodes, up into the armpit particularly. And if they got to the regional lymph nodes, then they could spread elsewhere in the body, right? And that was the common perception of how cancer spread. In fact, today I saw a patient in the office whose husband said, well, you're going to check the lymph nodes, because if it hasn't gone there, it couldn't have spread elsewhere. And as we'll talk about from clinical trials that were done, that's been proven not to be true. But Halsted said that the theory was that was then called the Halstedian hypothesis, that cancer spread in an orderly fashion from the breast to the lymph nodes and then elsewhere in the body. So the corollary to that is, if you can remove all of the breast and the lymph nodes and interrupt that process, you may be able to cure them. So Halsted developed and pioneered and really developed the technique of what's called radical mastectomy. So we don't do radical mastectomies anymore. I've done two or three in my entire career of 30 years doing breast surgery. But I do like to tell, sort of wake people up, the breast cancer audience is up, by telling that I would say that actually the development of the operation of radical mastectomy was probably the single biggest step forward in breast cancer research ever, because it took women from having this horrible, painful death where they had to go to the back room and die, to actually many of them living many years of high quality life, though they did so with this big, massive scar in their chest with all the muscles gone. And it was a big operation, but it was a huge step forward. Radical mastectomy takes all the muscle on the chest wall, the extended lymph nodes. So that operation became standard around the world for 70 years, 80 years, almost a century of women. If you had breast cancer, you had this horrible mutilating operation, during which time the cancers tended to be smaller and smaller. People no longer came to the doctor with these horrible big tumors. They came to the doctor when they felt a lump in their breast. But the doctor said, well, the treatment has to be radical mastectomy, because that's what we know cures people, because we interrupt this by taking out all the lymph nodes. So along comes somebody who says, wait a minute. We're doing this huge, big mutilating operation, which was very appropriate in Halsted's day because of the nature of what people came to him with. But these are different tumors. And is this really true? I mean, the doctor said, well, I see women who have negative lymph nodes on this operation, but they still develop widespread cancer and die from it. I challenge the hypothesis that it's an orderly progression of disease from the breast to the lymph nodes, to the rest of the body. So how could you address that question of, do you need to do this big, huge, disfiguring operation, or can you do something else? How would you, and the operation maybe you could do is, I don't like this term because it's sort of terrible term, simple mastectomy, where you just remove the breast and you leave the muscle and you don't remove any of the lymph nodes. Maybe you could do that. How would you do it? How would you actually test whether doing the extended radical mastectomy with all the extended lymph nodes versus doing a much lesser operation would be appropriate? And in fact, that doing that test might actually address the question of, is breast cancer truly this orderly progression, or is it what you might call a systemic disease from the time of diagnosis? In other words, has the cancer already had the chance to spread by other means than going to the lymph nodes? So how might you test that question? Pardon me? Sentinel lymph node wasn't described for another 40 years. How would you answer the question of whether this large, big operation was necessary or whether you could do much more limited surgery?
Could you just test it on a mouse model?
You could, and in fact, people have tried that in mouse models. So, but does the mouse model really project into humans?
Not always.
Not always. How would you test this in humans?
Pardon me?
Well, we'll talk about how we define the likelihood of somebody would have a spread of cancer, and grade is one of them. But that wouldn't really test. I mean, what clinical study would you do with grading to determine whether you need to do more aggressive surgery or not?
Metastasis in other parts of the body?
I have a group of women who have no evidence of metastasis in other parts of the body. And how would you design that clinical trial? And the other half would do a simple mastectomy. Is that an ethical thing to do?
I don't think so.
You don't believe so. Does other people think it's an ethical thing to do?
If you give informed consent.
So what if they don't join that clinical trial? What happens to them?
Standard of care.
And what's the standard of care? This is 1965. Extended radical mastectomy.
But if you give them the choice, most of them, there's probably a good subset who wouldn't want the radical mastectomy because of the pain involved and the disfiguration. Mm-hmm. So I feel like there would still be enough people to join the trial, even considering the fact that it might not prolong their lives.
So you'd have the people select which arm they wanted to be on.
I mean, it might skew the trial, but...
It might, yeah.
If you had enough people, I feel like it would probably...
So let's come back to that question. Is that question of using... People like to call that real-world data to answer clinical research questions rather than doing randomized clinical trials is resurfacing because of some of the nuances of therapies and some of the availability of getting large population-based data. But actually that concept of using real-world data now is coming to the fore, but that was not done. So is it ethical to randomize people between extended radical mastectomy and simple mastectomy?
Why is it not ethical?
Well, I'm asking. Some of the people here have already told me it's not.
And then there's the people that wouldn't want the radical mastectomy, so then you could only originally get people to join a trial who would be willing to get a radical mastectomy. Right?
That's correct. If you're going to do a trial, if somebody's going to join a randomized trial, they have to be told up front it's a randomized trial and that it's going to be the flip of a coin whether they get a radical mastectomy or simple mastectomy.
I feel like unless you know one works better than the other, it's not unethical.
There are people who would say the unethical part is doing the simple mastectomy because you don't have definitive proof that it's effective. So you might be putting the women in jeopardy by doing simple mastectomy. You might literally be putting them in jeopardy, right?
Isn't that the risk for all phase one?
Yeah. It's, well, phase three clinical trials. Yes, it is the risk of all phase three clinical trials that the experimental arm will prove not to be as effective as standard care. Well, it's effective in that if you don't do the radical mastectomy, people get horribly progressive disease and ultimately die of their breast cancer.
People are already dying anyway.
Half of them probably still ultimately die of breast cancer because of metastatic disease.
So,
but it would be 100% if you didn't do the surgery.
But you're not saying surgery or no surgery, like two different kinds of surgery.
So there was enough evidence from people who'd done series of people who had simple mastectomy, and there was enough evidence to suggest that this probably was the case, just like there was evidence in that bone marrow transplant example, right, to suggest that bone marrow transplant would be better. But we didn't have the definitive answer, so it was felt by a reasonable group of both cancer experts, doctors, and lay people, people who aren't in it, people who have no financial interest or no personal interest in the success or failure of the trial. It was felt that it's a reasonable question to ask. So it was felt that this was an ethical thing to do. And 900 women in the United States and Canada joined a trial between extended radical mastectomy. Okay, so they had, if there's the armpit, and there's the lymph nodes going up here, and some of them even remove the lymph nodes. There's a group of lymph nodes in the internal mammary chain, and you can get them by pulling them up from between the ribs. Extended radical mastectomy, where you did all of this, or the simple mastectomy, and there was a randomized clinical trial. And so this studied the question of, does extending the treatment to include the lymph nodes improve survival? And that really challenged the Halstedian hypothesis of the orderly progression of cancer, right? So that study was done, and here's the results. There was absolutely no difference in the outcome. And those women did not have any treatment of their lymph nodes. We do know that in the women that had the extended radical mastectomy, 40% of them or 50% of them had positive lymph nodes. So we can reasonably conclude that 40 to 50% of the women who had the simple mastectomy had lymph nodes with cancer left. Reasonable conclusion?
Can you repeat that?
40% of the women who had the radical mastectomy, where all the lymph nodes were removed and then, of course, were examined, had positive lymph nodes. They had the cancer spread to the lymph nodes. So since the women were randomly assigned between the two arms, it's a reasonable assumption that 40% of the women who had simple mastectomy, who did not have lymph nodes removed, that they also had positive nodes, except in their case, the positive nodes were left in them. Yet the fact that those lymph nodes with cancer were left in them did not change their survival. So that challenged and really disproved the hypothesis that it was this orderly progression of cancer from the tumor to the lymph nodes to elsewhere in the body. And Emery, you're sitting in the back. You're always welcome to jump in, by the way.
Okay.
Okay, please. If you want to embellish on something or...
Sure.
Yeah.
Didn't they ultimately find, though, that the randomization wasn't as random as they thought?
In this study? I don't believe that's true.
I thought it was...
That's news to me. Pardon me?
Cancer. I thought it was... Later, they found out that it really depended on the cancer, like the cancers weren't small.
I thought they said they put more of the later stage people into the
right.
Not in this study. And unless you know something I don't know about the study, and I don't believe that's true. But I'll even try to pull out of this. Now, if you were interested in trying to figure that out, the name of the study was NSABP-B04. NSABP.
If you can provide that reference, though.
Sure. Okay, and it's called the NSABP B04 trial, National Surgical Adjuvant Breast Project. Breast, they actually also do bowel cancer, so it's Breast 04, their fourth study. But I've never heard that there was anything but a standard true randomization in the study, that this study adequately tested this question. There's a couple of confounders. When you do a mastectomy, there's always a few lymph nodes that come with the specimen, and so the people who had simple mastectomy, there were a few lymph nodes, and some people who always said you still have to do extensive lymph node surgery hung their hat on that and say, well, it wasn't truly no lymph nodes removed, but there were three or four as opposed to 15 or 20 in the other group. But it really showed that you didn't need to do this extended surgery. Now, this study was started in 1971, and this was there was no evidence that chemotherapy had any impact on breast cancer. The first studies of chemotherapy in women with more advanced breast cancer were started in like 71, 72, 73. So none of these women received chemotherapy. So this is purely a surgical trial, comparing one surgery to the other. Very pure trial in that regard. So that really, you know, and so I started medical school in 1975. I started my clinical rotations in 1977. This trial was reported in like 1976, 1977. The use of radical mastectomy stopped like that. I never did a radical mastectomy in my training. If you talk to surgeons 8 years older than me, all they did in their training was radical mastectomy. This trial changed practice overnight. Because it's a horrible mutilating operation, or still a mutilating operation, but nothing like the radical mastectomy. So it also opened the question of, do we really need to do all this extensive surgery? And that's when this study was, the first results were coming out in 1976, the study group knew these results. It was then, people were then started saying, well, maybe we don't have to remove the entire breast. So how would you do a study to determine if you could do so-called lumpectomy? So if you have a tumor, you can just remove the tumor instead of removing the whole breast. How would you do that study? This is sort of a repetitive situation, isn't it? Same idea. You would take women and randomly assign them to receive lumpectomy or mastectomy. Now, again, if they didn't do that, everybody was treated with mastectomy. So, actually, the study was done, and there were actually three groups in the study. There were three groups. There was lumpectomy alone. I don't know that is there. I don't think there is a different marker. So there's three trials. There's lumpectomy alone, lumpectomy plus radiation treatments to the breast, and mastectomy. Oh, okay, you got some more. So there's three arms to the trial. The question was whether the cancer will grow back in the breast if you just do lumpectomy alone. So they addressed the question by having three arms to the study. I actually, the 20-year results of this study were reported about 10 years ago, or 10 or 12 years ago, and I was down in Bradford, Pennsylvania during Breast Cancer Awareness Month at the library talking to 100 women from the community about breast cancers. I told them the results of this study, and I said that because this study was done, every other woman in this room who now has breast cancer, because these 2,000 courageous women joined this study, which showed that you can do lumpectomy, and I'll show you the results in a second. Because those 2,000 women joined this trial, okay, 2 million people won't have to have mastectomy. This decade alone, 2 million women can be treated with lumpectomy without having their breast removed, because those 2,000 women were courageous enough in 1976 to join this study. And it was really poignant for me because I noticed that a woman in the front row started smiling from ear to ear. And he said, is anybody in this room on the NSABP B06 study? And she, of course, raised her hand. 20 years later, she's alive and well. Which treatment do you think she got? Have I given you enough information to tell what treatment she got? She was just pleased, smiling from ear to ear, that because she participated in the study, other women didn't have to have mastectomy. Which treatment do you think she got? Or have I not given you enough information? Pardon me? Yeah. That's what you guess. Most people guess that, but in fact, the answer is I've been giving enough information because it's a randomized trial, right? Right. And she actually had been treated with mastectomy, but she was just as proud, just as pleased. She didn't choose to have a mastectomy. She joined a study. If she hadn't joined the study, she would have had mastectomy no matter what, right? She didn't choose to have it. She chose, made the active choice to join the trial. And because she did, and she and 2,000 other women, the 2 million women following in the next decade in the United States alone didn't have to have a mastectomy. Very poignant, actually. I found that a very poignant encounter, and I still remember that even to this day. I can tell you exactly where she was sitting and tell you how the room was shaped. You know, it was very poignant to me. So what that study showed is three lines superimposed. Okay? No difference in survival, so you can now have clear evidence, and this is out to 20 years. So We actually know that you can do lumpectomy, and when you do an appropriate lumpectomy, and this was for tumors up to 4 centimeters in size, which is a pretty big tumor, actually. But the average size was 2.2 or 2.3. We now, because of mammography was not routinely being done at that time, so all these women came with a lump they could feel. With mammography, we now see the average tumor size we probably see is 1.2 centimeters or something. We see much smaller tumors than we used to. So we see there's no difference. And notice that adding radiation did not improve survival, right? If you looked at recurrence in the breast, the cancer coming in back in the breast, the recurrence in the breast, the local recurrence rate, we call this local recurrence. The local recurrence rate was mastectomy was about 3%. You can have a skin. You can have the cancer come back in the skin. In lumpectomy alone, it was 40%. And it was 12% in the group that got radiation. But again, no difference in survival, actually. So you could treat these women in general who have a local recurrence in the breast after lumpectomy, and you have the same survival. And that's even more ammunition to support the fact that breast is not this orderly progression between the three, because it's more likely the grade of the cancer, as we heard earlier, the factors about the biologic properties of the cancer that define its spread and not the actual tumor itself. So these were truly landmark trials. Now this trial was clouded by some falsified data. There was a doctor at a hospital in Canada who entered about 300 patients onto the trial. The 2,000 women on the trial entered about 300 women on the trial, and the trial said you had to do everything within 60 days. Well, he had trouble getting a bone scan on the trial or something like that. They all had to have a bone scan before, and he had trouble getting it. So he had a number of people and he put a lot of people on his trial. He had a number of people who were put on the trial who had the bone scan three or five or 10 days too late because he couldn't get them scheduled, and he put them on the trial anyway. So they were ineligible for the trial by the trial specifications. And it came to light a number of years later, and the National Cancer Institute spent like $5 or $10 million to investigate it. And it was a huge brouhaha. The head of the trial, who lives in Pittsburgh, was almost crucified. I mean, it was terrible. He actually finally sued the NCI and got $7 million in a settlement because it wasn't he who forged the data, and they had very good mechanisms to try to capture it. In fact, they did catch it later. But remember, this trial was done in the 1970s. Now you couldn't even begin to do this because everything's computerized, and it's very hard to falsify stuff now as it was 40 years ago when everything was done on paper. But anyways, they then reanalyzed the data with these patients excluded, looked at these patients alone, and there's no difference. And so the study really is a valid study. And every other study that's looked at this question has said that there's no value in terms of long-term outcome. Subsequent stuff shows that this was also done in the days before chemotherapy and in the days before hormonal therapy for breast cancer. And the local recurrence rate is actually only about 4 or 5% in people who get lumpectomy and radiation therapy. And about 3%, and assuming people get appropriate drug treatments for their breast cancer. So lumpectomy radiation therapy is now the preferred treatment for most women with breast cancer. There's a few reasons why people still have mastectomy, very large tumors. A few women will have multiple tumors in the breast at the same time. And there's a clinical trial that's been ongoing to try to take women with two separate cancers in the breast and do two lumpectomies. And a few women have mastectomy because they have a genetic mutation which results in them having inherited susceptibility for breast cancer, which are the, what genes? What are the most common? BRCA, right. And they're the most common, though we now actually have a large panel. I saw a woman today with a PALB2 gene mutation, which is another gene. It's a quite uncommon mutation. Don't ask me what PALB2 actually, PALB2, really does. But those women also have a higher risk of breast cancer, and she wants bilateral mastectomy. And we went back and forth over the pros and cons of doing that. It was about 11 o'clock this morning. But some women with gene mutations related to inherited susceptibility choose to have bilateral mastectomy because they have a very high risk of developing another breast cancer in the future. It doesn't actually help their current breast cancer, but it helps the cancer they already have. So in the 1970s and 80s, these kind of clinical trials were done and clearly have demonstrated that you don't need to do the very aggressive surgery that took took almost 100 years to get rid of the radical mastectomy from the early 1880s till really it was the late 1980s before many doctors were really willing to start abandoning mastectomy. So that was a real interesting ride. Everything else since the original BO4 trial of radical mastectomy versus simple mastectomy have been small incremental steps. Yes?
Paul B2 is also known as St. Anne, right? It's the St. Tony.
Okay.
It is a partner and localizer, BRCA2.
Okay.
And it is located on chromosome 16.
Thank you. It's interesting. She was advised by one doctor to go have her ovaries removed. And with BRCA mutations, they're also at risk for ovarian cancer. And women who have a BRCA mutation, it's more important than removing their breasts. It's more important when they're done having children or postmenopausal to remove their ovaries, because ovary cancer is more lethal. And there's no screening for ovarian cancer. There's no effective screening for ovarian cancer. So, but I had never heard some doctor here in Buffalo had told her that she should go have her ovaries removed because she had this gene mutation. And I've never heard that there was. The company literature says it's a slight increased risk, and I found a paper published from the best group in the world, which is up in Toronto, on this subject. Steve Narod is the guy's name who runs the group, which did very detailed analysis of thousands and thousands of patients. And it concluded there is no evidence of an association between PALP B2 mutations and ovarian cancer, and this should demonstrably affect your counseling of patients with PALP B2 mutations. So I think I've stayed the knife on that one on her. But, there are some reasons why people have mastectomy still. And, technically, if you read the literature, it's the woman's choice as to whether she wants a mastectomy or not. You know, I counsel a lot of women about this. Most women I talk to, when they recognize that there's no advantage to their having a mastectomy, they want to have a lumpectomy because they don't want to have a big operation. And it's not vanity. It's, you don't want to have a big operation versus a small operation. You have a mastectomy, many women have reconstruction. You go through multiple operations, a lot of time with the doctor as opposed to an in-and-out operation. Radiation treatments of the breast that takes 4 weeks and you're done. This has become the preferred treatment for breast cancer. And in fact, there's some population data from real world data, like we were talking about earlier, where people have looked at tens and tens of thousands of people and tried to control for the factors that they can control for within the populations that they're being studied. You know, if you take a large data set, a cancer registry data set or other large data sets from real world data, you can't control for all the factors that might be different between the populations. I mean, there are reasons why somebody might have a mastectomy versus a lumpectomy. Bigger tumor, for example, or maybe, you know, nuances of things that you won't be captured in the registry. But when trying to control for everything they can, have actually suggested the survival is actually a little better for women getting lumpectomy radiation. And it's theorized that that's because they get radiation and that addresses any microscopic lymphatic spread outside the actual tumor that's in the skin, skin that would be preserved with mastectomy. Remember that we said that a small percentage of women have recurrence in the skin after mastectomy. On top of these clinical trials, has now been built in 30 years of clinical trial research in breast cancer. And started with in the mid-1970s with studies looking at, well, we know that women with negative lymph nodes. What is associated with bad outcomes in breast cancer? We said one of them, lymph nodes metastases. If you have lymph node metastases, it's more likely to spread to other parts of the body, right? But it's that negative lymph nodes does not mean that it hasn't spread. But if you have positive lymph nodes, it's more likely to spread. Grade of cancer. Grade of cancer is another factor that is associated with poor outcome. A patient, all things being equal, a tumor that's high grade is more likely to have metastasized than one with low grade. Are there other factors? Grade, lymph node status? Okay, HER2 is clearly a prognostic factor. HER2 was described in the early 1990s, and human epidermal growth factor receptor 2, and it's associated with proliferation. And women who have HER2 positive cancers are clearly the bad actors. I mean, if you look at women with if you look at the subtypes of breast cancer, the luminal subtypes, the estrogen receptor positive subtypes, the survival will be that. You look at the triple-negative breast cancers, which we right now think are the really bad cancers right now. You've heard about triple-negative cancers? We think those are the really bad cancers because they're not responsive to therapy. Well, if you go back 15 years ago when HER2 was first being described and there were no HER2-directed therapies, HER2 cancers were this. Triple-negative, luminal, which were the ER-positive. Okay? So HER2 cancers were the really bad actors. We don't think of them as the really bad actors anymore because along with the development, with the understanding of HER2, a guy named Dennis Slamon working with Genentech developed an antibody, a monoclonal antibody to HER2, demonstrated in animal models that in the laboratory and then in animal models showed that it would actually bind to cells, cause lysis, actually improved outcomes for mouse and animal models of breast cancer. And then it was done with phase one testing. And if you ever read the book, I don't know, have you read the book, Emperor of All Maladies? Oh, great. Well, in that book is the story of HER2, right? Have you gotten to that part of the story yet? Have you seen the picture of the woman who had, I mean, you know, the story is just spine, it just makes your spine tingle that he called this woman and said, you've got all this expression of HER2. Will you be our first person to take trastuzumab? And according to the story, she said, "No, I'm done. I've tried every experimental drug everybody wants me to try, and I'm done. I'm home to die." And he called her back the next day. Said, "I just couldn't take no for an answer." And the picture was taken 10 years later. Right? You know, it's just a spine tingling story. It's one of the great miracles. I did see a woman today who's got a HER2 positive cancer who's had a local recurrence after 15 years in the chest wall. And she's had a dramatic response to endocrine therapy, and it was found to be HER2 positive. She took two cycles of Herceptin, and then she said she didn't feel like taking it anymore. That was exactly my Dr. Block is sitting in the back. That was exactly my response. I said, "Ma'am, please. It's gotten almost no toxicity. You don't know. This is one of the great miracles of modern medicine." And so now the HER2 positive cancers look like this. Okay, with appropriate treatment, the HER2 positive cancers so this has been a series of clinical trial research and of comparing, starting with drug therapies and first starting in people with very advanced cancers, lymph node positive cancers, and then moving on to people with less advanced cancers.
See, the patient with HER2 positive, how long do they stay on therapy?
That's how would you determine how long to keep somebody on therapy, Emery? How would you determine? A clinical trial, and in fact, the original trials of Herceptin, I should say trastuzumab, in the adjuvant setting, in women like this who have had treatment and have no evidence of metastases, there were a number of clinical trials that started around 1998, 2000, something like that, and reported in 2005, 2006. Most of them said, they arbitrarily said, we're going to give them every 3 week trastuzumab for a year. The French did a study with only like 300 patients in it where they gave it to them for 6 doses. And there was no difference between the benefit they saw. The odds ratio for recurrence were the same in the women who got it for 6 doses, so for about 4 months, compared to the women who got it for a year in the other trials. There's subsequently been trials comparing those two times, and the longer duration therapy is a little bit better, so the standard is still to give it for a year. There have also been clinical trials looking at whether you should do it for 2 years versus 1 year, and there's no benefit of 2 years over 1 year. So we give the drugs for 1 year. And then after trastuzumab was developed, people developed other agents that affected HER2 functions, other antibodies, other agents that affected its interaction intracellularly. So there's a whole variety of anti-HER2 drugs out there now. And, pardon me? And actually the combination of two of the anti-HER2 drugs, pertuzumab and trastuzumab, is better than trastuzumab alone. So, in fact, the standard treatment for people with particularly bad large breast cancers or those with multiple lymph nodes involved is to give them chemotherapy plus 2 anti-HER2 agents. Dr. Block did bring up the point of cost. The trastuzumab costs about $70,000 for a year, and the pertuzumab costs about $70,000 for a year, and the chemotherapy probably costs about $40,000 to $50,000 a year, so you're talking $200,000 worth of drugs. It's not trivial. The costs are not trivial. So, in fact, if you could show that 6 weeks of therapy or six doses of therapy were equal, you could save a heck of a lot of money, right? clinical trials have, these kind of randomized clinical trials have been done for virtually everything. One of the interesting things was that the clinical trials for lymph node negative breast cancer were done, so they took women with lymph node negative breast cancer with both ER positive and ER negative breast cancer. Oh, well, I guess you have to use this stuff. Back when I was in school, it was a blackboard with chalk. So. Take women with lymph node negative breast cancers, where the recurrence rate for small lymph node negative breast cancers, the chance of developing distant metastasis may be, without therapy, maybe 20%. Okay, so you took women. Ooh, that looks good. So you took women, and let's make this 100, and this 90, and this 80. Okay? And you took women without chemotherapy, and you'd find something like this, down to 85% at 10 years, say. And then you give them chemotherapy for 6 months after their surgery. At this point, you give them that, and you see this. And there's 3,000 women in the study, and this 3% absolute difference has a p-value of 0.0001. So it's highly significant.
Wait, what is that y-axis?
The y-axis is years, 10 years. No, I'm sorry, the y-axis is percent survival, 80, 90, 100, and years. So you see this at absolute benefit of a 3% survival advantage. To achieve that, 100 women had to get chemotherapy. Now, two or three of those women will have permanent congestive heart failure from the chemotherapy. One in a thousand of them, like Robin Roberts, the TV announcer, will get leukemia from the cytoxin. So, but to achieve that benefit, so is that worth giving 100 women chemotherapy? What do you think? Pardon me?
Over time, I guess it would potentially add up to more than that.
Well, I mean, at 20 years, the benefit probably lasts out of 20 years. It's probably the same 3 or 4%. So is that worth it? Of course, to those 3 or 4 women, of course it is, right? So, actually, people have then, this is where people have really looked to try to do profiling of tumors and identify the biologic potential of tumors based on things other than size, lymph node status, ERPR, HER2, proliferation markers, KS67, there's others. People have tried to actually do genomic profiling of these tumors, and in fact, from one of these trials that did this, they were able to get the paraffin blocks from that trial, and they had 20 years follow-up on these patients, and they... this group looked at 100. They actually looked at the expression of 150 genes and came up with a model using 16 of those genes plus 5 reference genes, and were able to show the data I'll show you. Now, you tell me what everybody's concern about this was. They used paraffin-embedded tissue, and they looked at RNA expression. What was the problem with that?
It's degraded.
Yeah, it's degraded. And when they first came out with this, everybody said, that's poppycock, because you use RNA, an RNA-based assay, and paraffin. The paraffin, what you do with paraffin, you put the tissue in formaldehyde, right? That when you take the tissue out, you cut it up and you put it in formaldehyde. And the formaldehyde slowly penetrates the tissue at a rate of what? A couple millimeters an hour? Something like that. So you have a 6 millimeter thick piece of tissue. It will take 4 hours to get fixed. During that 4 hours, the RNA is just tearing down all the RNA, right? So that's why they proved that this worked. They had these 5 reference genes, and I think I'm just a surgeon, so I may not express this correctly, but the 5 reference genes, they expect to have a certain level of expression in basically all the cells of the body, and myosin, you know, things like that, And they said, well, we're only at 5% of the level we expect in the normal cells of the body, so we multiply by 20 to get the expression when the tumor tissue is alive. And I guess the hypothesis is that all the RNA is broken down at the same rate, so all the other genes that they measure, they multiply by 20. And they derive, they have a model that derives a score based on this, and it accurately predicts survival, and it's been demonstrated in other trials, both retrospectively and prospectively, to work. So they now are able to take all of these women, and they're able to separate them out into three groups. They separated out into three groups. It's actually a continuous variable, but they separated into three groups of a low score. So this was the for people at a low score in this genomic profile, this was the survival of the both curves on the low score, okay? So they had an X with the low score, they had a 98% survival at 10 years. And there was no benefit to chemotherapy. They all took the anti-estrogen therapy, by the way. They all took tamoxifen was the drug. But there was no difference with chemotherapy, okay? If they had a high score, this was the curve without chemo, and this was the curve with chemo. Okay? And the absolute difference is something like 20%. Is that worth it to give 100 people chemotherapy? Yeah, I think most of us would say, yeah, that's worth it. So is this worth it to get chemotherapy with a low score? No, of course not. Then there was, they also had a third group that they called an intermediate score, and they did better, and that's without chemotherapy, with chemotherapy, and that's without chemotherapy, and the p-value is like 0.2. So probably no benefit. They're actually, people were so scared about this, and of course I'm a cynic sometimes. The medical oncologist didn't want to have all their chemotherapy disappear right away. So they said, well, we're too nervous about the intermediate group. We should do a randomized clinical trial that will take 10 years to complete and test the question of whether chemotherapy is valuable in the intermediate group. And that clinical trial has been done. It's now been filled for over 5 years, and we haven't heard the result. We're assuming, therefore, they're not seeing any difference between the groups. Otherwise, if they saw a difference between the groups already, they would have reported the study. So we're assuming that's going to show there's no difference for intermediate chemotherapy. The use of chemotherapy in estrogen receptor positive lymph node negative breast cancer, which is what this was done, is the use of chemotherapy in the United States in this group of people has done that. Because this is only about 15% of the cases have the high score. And this is 60% of the cases, and this is about 20% of the cases, the intermediate score. So 60%, you're right off the top. The use of chemotherapy in lymph node negative breast cancer, where 15 years ago, almost everybody under age 75 or 70 was advised to get chemotherapy to get this 3% benefit. We now tell them, most of them, good news, your cancer's biology is such that we don't need to give chemotherapy. So, and where we're going to go with new targeted therapies and where immunotherapy is going to come into play. Immunotherapy is being shown to be effective in virtually every tumor type, right? And there's evidence to show that it's effective in advanced breast cancer. I mean, this is a brave new world that you guys are going to be people to make the great discoveries. They're going to change this paradigm dramatically. I actually believe that in the next 15 years that we will not do surgery on most women with breast cancer. Because we will identify the tumors, identify the biology, give them targeted therapies, and we will be able to, for those people with small tumors, be able to put a needle probe into the tumor and freeze it and kill the cancer in situ, and then maybe give radiation to the breast and not do surgery. We will stop doing lymph node surgery. Lymph node surgery dates back to Dr. Halstead in the 1880s, and as I said earlier, that mutilating, horrible operation he did was probably the single biggest step forward in treating breast cancer, because it took women from having horrible, incurable disease to having many years of quality life, even though many of them still ultimately died of breast cancer. Despite that, that mutilating surgery is not necessary, and we now are able to predict the biology of breast cancer without doing lymph node surgery. This test, which by the way is called Oncotype. This is the trade name for it, called Oncotype DX. And there's a whole group of other genomic profiling assays that are commercially available that can be applied. It costs $4,000 to do that test, by the way. It's only done at one laboratory. Dr. Block and her group do not do Oncotype testing in their lab because, among other things, the company that made it holds a patent. And they like to make $5,000 or $4,000 per test, right? And they're doing probably $50,000 or $70,000 or $80,000 a year. So do the math, you know. They're doing $400 million of business a year, $500 million of business a year. That there's a clinical trial that's been done in women with node-positive breast cancer, and almost certainly will show that it's just as predictive in node-positive breast cancer. And so if it's just as predictive in node-positive breast cancer, we've already showed that removing the lymph nodes doesn't improve survival, right? The very first study that was done, right? Why do we bother doing the lymph node surgery? We're going to stop doing lymph node surgery. And of course, we do sentinel node biopsy. That's another series of clinical trials that have limited the extent of lymph node surgery that we have to do to adequately define whether the lymph nodes are involved. So we're going to stop doing lymph node surgery. We're going to be able to freeze tumors. A clinical trial has already started here. This is a phase two. This is not even a phase trial. To see if we give chemotherapy before surgery and the person has a dramatic shrinkage of the tumor, 30, 40, 50% of them, when you actually do the surgery, there's no cancer in the tissue. They have a complete response. Okay? Why do we do the surgery if they've got a complete response? Well, we can't really tell who's got a complete response. We can tell that it appears to have disappeared on x-rays or by exam, but still 50% of those people have viable tumor. We still do the surgery. There's a national clinical trial right now taking people who have a dramatic response clinically, doing multiple biopsies. I signed a woman up for this study today. Multiple biopsies of the tumor bed, and it has no impact on her care. She goes to surgery like she would have anyway. If those biopsies, if we correlate, biopsy shows no tumor and breast shows complete response to the tumor, so we know that biopsy accurately predicts response to the tumor, then maybe we can define who doesn't need it. So that she's purely out of altruism because she knows that her treatment is based on 100,000 women who were on clinical trials before her. Okay, out of pure altruism, she's going to let us stick a needle in her breast 5 times. Okay, and get these biopsies. If those biopsies are accurately predict whether the cancer has completely responded in the breast, the next clinical trial that will start 3 years from now is to take women who have neoadjuvant chemotherapy and have a complete response and have a negative biopsy and randomize them between surgery and no surgery. So I actually believe that 15 years from now we won't do any breast surgery. I would not advise any of you if you go to medical school to go into breast surgery right now. It's a dying field. And it's good. So, anyways, it's 5 o'clock. Any other questions?
Yeah. And not everybody might be familiar with how the sentinel node biopsies studies are done.
Oh, sure. I mean, if you look at the axilla or the armpit, I'm not a great artist, but if there's the breast and here's the shoulder and here's the axilla here, and here's the rib cage here. So you have the rib cage here, and here's the main vein coming out of the arm called the axillary vein. So this is the vein, which comes right in here, right? And the chest wall, and the latissimus muscle down here. There's this triangular piece of tissue here, which contains the axillary lymph nodes. There's between 10 and 20 lymph nodes in there. And until 20 years ago, the only way to know whether lymph nodes were involved were to do surgery to remove this entire block of tissue, which is a safe operation, but it leaves women with it takes. There's also lymphatics draining the arm, which drain right through this, and 15% of women who do that on get permanent swelling of the arm from blockage of the lymphatics. It's called lymph edema. So the only way until the mid-1990s or late 1990s was to do a full axillary lymph node dissection. Some people first starting other types of cancer, particularly melanoma, hypothesized that you could inject a large particle-sized material into the tissue around where the tumor was. It would get into the lymphatics. It would drain up through the lymphatics until it got to a lymph node, and that large particle size would actually just, by physical characteristics, by the fact that it's a large particle, it would not be able to traverse the sinusoids of the lymph node. It would get trapped in the lymph node. And if you could find that large particle size in the lymph node, the theory would be that that would be the same cancer, the same lymph node the cancer would go to, and all you got to do is remove those lymph nodes. That process of injecting this large material, it's a colloidal material, large particle-sized material, into the breast, and then identifying in the lymph nodes which lymph nodes have taken up that colloidal material is called sentinel node biopsy. The lymph node that's the sentinel, the one that's standing on guard, that's what a sentinel is, right? There are The initial colloidal material was a blue-colored dye, which has large particle size, called isosulfan blue. Other than people used a material called sulfur colloid, which is a large particle size, and with the sulfur colloid, they tagged it with technetium-99, a gamma emitter radioactive material. Early 1990s, the first studies were done, confirmatory studies were done. I did one of the first confirmatory studies, started in 1995 here. Sentinel nodes weren't accepted widely until 2001, 2002, but after I did 50 patients, and so it was 100% accurate. I couldn't look a woman in the eye and tell her she needed this operation. So in 1997, we stopped doing full axillary lymph node dissection. We were actually criticized nationally for doing that. So you don't have the proof that that's an accurate technique yet. And there actually then a large clinical trial, randomized clinical trial, was started. I actually wrote a paper showing that all the big cancers in America were already doing it and said, I don't think the randomized trial needs to be done. After all this stuff I've given you about randomized trials, I don't think it needs to be done. The PI in that trial wrote the editorial in the journal, the NCI. He was blustering. He was so mad at me. In press, he was blustering. He's never spoken to me since that day. But we challenged the concept that the clinical trial of sentinel node versus full or actually node dissection needed to be done. Now, I cite that study was done. It had 3,000 people on it. 1,500, in my mind, 1,500 people in that trial had an unnecessary actually node dissection because we already knew the information that it was accurate. So in my mind, it was an unnecessary study. Though I cite the study all the time, it shows no difference in outcome, survival, and blah, blah, blah. So it was a well-designed trial. So that's how we do. So now we just remove this. The average number of nodes that take up that colloidal material is 2 or 3, and we take out those lymph nodes. The risk of lymphedema is about 2% in that group, as opposed to 15%. Huge, a big advance. But I think that'll disappear in 10 years, because I don't think we'll be doing lymph node surgery routinely. All right, it's 5 o'clock on a weekend. In fact, it's past 5 o'clock on a weekend. So. Yeah.